how amazing is it that I get to be here? I get to do this. But that what if really got us to that gold medal, because I think dreaming big, dreaming gold was almost too big for me to wrap my head around. So you had to break it down. Okay, how do I get a gold medal? Well, to get a gold medal, I have to have my best race.
On the show today, Andrea Proska, here to talk about the resilience needed to transform herself into an Olympic champion. As you listen to my episode today with Andrea Proska, I want you to reflect on your own life and think about deep aspirations that you currently have. If you could wave a magic wand and make a dream of yours happen, what would that dream be? And as you think about this dream or aspiration, how possible does it feel to you? If you were to fully immerse yourself in the process of trying to achieve this dream for real in your life, what would it look like? And what confidence would you have in your own ability to actually be able to achieve this dream? So many of us have dreams and aspirations, and getting started on a journey that will guide us toward achieving these dreams can be the hardest step to take. As famous coach John Wooden says, success is never final, failure is never fatal, it's courage that counts. And having the courage to truly pursue our dreams is what counts. Research often shows time and again that fear is what holds people back from following their heart when it comes to pursuing a dream. Another quote that comes to mind when I think of this is a quote from psychologist Dr. Carl Jung. The cave you fear to enter holds the treasure you seek. My guest today epitomizes what it means to follow a dream and to completely transform oneself into an Olympic champion. Andrea Proska joins me for a discussion today about her amazing life journey. And at 27 years old, Andrea had very limited experience with team sport. And although an active person by nature, she had never really pursued excellence in her life through sport, let alone had never rowed in her life. At 27 years old, she was working in the hotel industry at the time and had the opportunity to compete in her first Tough Mudder race. Anybody who has experienced this race knows how tough it can be, hence the name, right? But the race really inspired her and left her afterwards with a feeling like she really needed something different. She wanted to change her life and to find something new and challenging to tackle. And as she says in this episode, she really felt stuck in her life at the time without really knowing what to do. So she was trying to think of what that challenge was going to be for her and wasn't sure at the time, but she would go on to give rowing a try. And what a story this turned out to be, as 3 short years later, she earned herself a spot on the Canadian Women's National Rowing Team. An amazing feat. In our conversation today, we unpack the roles of resilience and determination in Andrea's life, and how she was able to overcome numerous obstacles throughout the 8 years that she took up the sport of rowing, including a serious accident in 2015. In Andrea's own words, this is from her website, "Failing forward quickly became her motto. She braved injuries, underperformance, the firing of an abusive head coach, falling out of the boat more times than she cares to admit, a global pandemic, and a historic Olympic postponement. But along the way, She learned valuable lessons on handling failure, burnout, uncertainty, and the power of sisterhood. On Friday, July 30th, 2021, Andrea Proska's dreams came true as her and her team of nine won Canada's first gold medal in rowing in nearly 20 years. In this episode, Andrea talks about the Tokyo Olympics and what life has been like since winning the gold. She also shares the work she is doing now and what her biggest hopes are in moving forward in her life. Wherever you are in the world listening to this, I genuinely want to thank you for your time and for trusting in my podcast and the stories I share on the podcast itself. I hope you find value in this discussion, as there is so much that we can learn from Andrea's journey. Thanks for tuning in, and with that, let's jump right into my discussion with the inspiring Andrea Proska. Okay, Andrea, it's fantastic to have you on the show. We've been in contact over the past few months. I know you've been super busy since the Tokyo Olympics, and it's been great to see your journey on Instagram, a little bit on Twitter, but people will have already heard a little bit about you before jumping into this conversation in my introduction of you. So they'll already have a bit of background context, but in advance to our conversation, I genuinely want to thank you for your time and energy today and for being on my podcast.
So happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So let's just jump right into kind of a background. So I would like you to provide some background and context for our conversation today. So let us know who you are and what you're most known for, and then we'll jump into some other areas of discussion.
Sounds good. My name is Andrea Proska. I'm based in Langley, British Columbia, and I am a gold medalist from the Olympic Games, Tokyo 2020. I won gold for Canada in the women's eight. So that's that big boat that ironically has nine people in it. And we won gold for the first time since 1996 for Canada. So really proud of that accomplishment.
Yeah, as you should be. And we actually met at Pearson Airport right after the Olympics. You were flying on to Vancouver, I think, or someplace. Maybe the UK.
I was actually going, right to the UK. And I got to meet you and your family and share that gold medal with your family and your kids. And that was a really special moment for me.
Yeah.
First, you were one of the first people I saw outside of Japan. So it's nice to come full circle and see you now. However many days later, 100 something days later.
Yeah. The amazing thing is the connection we have. So first of all, we lived 10 years in Japan. Just watching the Tokyo Olympics was a special experience. And I remember watching the race, seeing the highlights of the race and just how amazing that was to see you and your team win the gold. And then suddenly I meet you in the airport and you were so gracious with your time, and the boys still talk about it to this day. And my sons got to hold the gold medal. And then I want to do an early flyover of your life. So can you just describe what kind of kid you were and what your early interests were? Again, this is just helping set the context for your life journey, but I'd be interested to know a little bit about early days.
Oh, I mean, early days, Andrea, I think was very much like everyone else, loved horses, studious, loved to read, voracious reader. In fact, my mom would have to hide the latest Harry Potter books for me to encourage me to do my chores. So I also became quite a good speed reader because I knew I only had them for a little bit of time. Yeah. Lots of playing outside. We grew up for 3 years in the Netherlands. My father is German. My mother is Canadian. So I grew up speaking both languages. And I think being over in the Netherlands and traveling a lot with my family gave me a great exposure to other cultures and other ways of life outside of Langley.
Yeah, our boys, they've never lived in Canada. So they were born in Hiroshima, Japan. And since that time, we've gone on to live in four other countries. So they've never lived in Canada, but Canada is near and dear to their heart. So they've learned so much through those experiences and they've developed a lot of strengths. And when I think of your story and anybody's story, anybody who has really strived for both personal and professional excellence in their life, they've developed early strengths. So when you think about your own life, what are some of those early strengths that you think you developed that went on to serve you so well?
Oh, well, I mean, for thinking about how you are as a kid and how that translates to later on in life, I see some similarities. Was always hated being told what to do, and always wanted to be brave and like the boys. So I think Dad will tell you one of his proudest moments of me is I was playing outside with two boys, neighborhood boys that came over, and a snake, a little garter snake, slithered through the grass and under a rock. And they went, "Oh, a snake." And I go, "Oh, do you want to see it?" Reached into the hole, grabbed the snake, and they went screaming back to the house. But, you know, I always wanted to be, you know, like my dad and tough and smart like my mom. And chase the boys with the snakes, I guess.
So what role did physical activity and sport play in your life?
So my mother is incredibly active. My father was as well. He had surgery on his spine when he was about the age I am now to remove a cancerous tumor. So he is not able to run anymore. But my mother always ran. She did marathons. So I grew up in a household with lots of fresh vegetables, homegrown foods, fresh cooked foods, you know, no junk food, and a really, really great foundation to health and well-being. I mean, being active was just an inherent way of life for me.
Mm-hmm. And did you participate in recreational sport, or was it more individual pursuit type sports, or?
I think my parents did a good job of making sure that I got lots of different opportunities to explore and to play. I'll admit I was more interested in horseback riding than any physical pursuits. I would run, but sports really didn't play a huge role in my life. And part of that is, as we're transitioning to high school life, is turning into quite a tall girl. I'm 6'1" now. Everyone would always say, "Well, you should do basketball. You should do volleyball." And I kind of rebelled about that because it seemed like an easy path forward. So instead, let's focus on other things, other passions. So for me, that was drama, theater management, art. And I kind of put up with being active, but never really loved it, never really pursued it.
Yeah, that's amazing when you think of your journey. And I'm sure you've been told this, and you yourself probably understand how amazing that is, that a lot of elite athletes were driven by sport from an early age. But again, thinking about your own life and some of your early strengths through the arts. So I am an instructional coach for art teachers and music teachers and PE teachers and librarians. And I think the arts provide people such a great sense of curiosity and exploration and creativity. And there's so much that can be taken from that. And when I think of your journey, when you think of your own journey, do you think being interested in the arts provided you with certain tools and skills that went on to serve you in your sporting life?
I think so. I think I've always been creative. I've always been big picture thinking. I've always been innovative. And especially working in drama, the thing that I was most interested in was stage manager. So being theater production. So how did things fit together? You know, how do you make something happen? Where do you look? Where are those gains? What needs to happen? How do you have, you know, this kind of agile management system of, you know, looking in a lot of different areas to achieve one goal. So when I look at what it takes to win a gold medal, I can't tell you it's one thing or it's a linear path, because it absolutely is not. You have to get those inches from a multitude of places, because we're winning and losing races by 0.1 seconds. Mm-hmm. So those inches are all around you. You just got to find them.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And knowing about your story, again, I really want to dive into the theme of resilience. And I want to read you the Penn State University Resilience Program definition of resilience. And as you listen to the definition, I want you to think about what resonates with you in regards to your own life and the resilient spirit that you have developed, okay? So the definition that they share with their students at Penn State is, resilience is characterized by the ability to bounce back from negative emotional experiences and by the flexible adaptation to the changing demands of stressful experiences. So basically, to get back on course when things don't go your way, when you think of your own life, what resonates when you hear that definition?
I think I'm struck by how many moments I'd characterize myself as being resilient. You know, I could, when I tell people the story of my career, quite often it's the story beats are the failures or the times where I didn't achieve something. So that could be being cut from the boat that I qualified for the Olympics. That could be being hit by the car in 2015. That could be falling out of the boat when I first decided to row. Or even, you know, before that in my life before, you know, being in tough relationships where I wasn't the master, you know, where I was what I would characterize as finding yourself again out of that. So yeah, absolutely. Lots of themes to pick out from that. It certainly speaks to me.
And that's the thing about resilience is some people think that either a person has a resilient spirit or they don't, or suddenly it just shows up in their life. But resilience is not something that just happens. You know, resilience is something that we build over time through various experiences. And can you think of any particular, like you mentioned a few things right there that I've read about and I've learned about in your story, the falling out of the boat, like when you first started rowing, that's a great story. And you learn to bounce back from it and not be defined by that failure in the moment. But what were some early obstacles that you feel you overcame to help keep you moving forward in your life in positive and productive ways?
Well, we can talk about the car accident because I think that's probably an analogy that a lot of people can understand. So in 2015, I was recovering from multiple rib fractures already. So I was on my bike and I was doing a training run and I came to six lanes of traffic and a bike path that goes across it. And I waited. The first lane stopped. It was fine. I moved forward. The second lane slammed on the brakes, almost got hit by the car behind and went, wow, that could have been close. I could have really been injured there. And I looked and the coast was clear and I went forward and the SUV hit me. It broke my carbon fiber frame in half, threw me across the road. Luckily I wasn't clipped in. And I had my helmet on and yeah, I mean, it was tough in the moment because I remember lying in that hospital bed and just seeing that my new career that I had only started about a year and a half ago that I had put everything on hold for could be taken away in an instant. And I decided, I think then and there, that I wasn't going to let the career be taken away from me, my sport being and my dreams be taken away from me, that if I wanted to walk away from sport, that I was going to do everything to keep that power within myself and to walk away on my own terms. Mm-hmm. So one of my first calls was to my coach to say, you know, I'm going to come back. This isn't the end. Just wait, I'm coming back for this. And I did. It took much longer than anticipated. I did have some physical injuries, you know, that required, say, cortisone injections into my spine and pieces of bone breaking off in my elbow. But overall, very, very, very lucky. I think the biggest setback was definitely the concussive fallout. I hadn't really dealt with a concussion before. I feel like I might've got one when I lived in Whistler for 3 years, did lots of snowboarding and slammed my head against a tree once, but nothing like this. Forgetting three digits of your parking stall number in the three steps that it took to walk away. I worked with an occupational therapist for a while with the sole goal of just remembering five items when I go to the grocery store. You know, I still find myself conversations kind of just moving on without me. It's kind of like you're watching a parade and then all of a sudden you turned around and looking in the bushes and you're like, oh, I really wanted to watch their parade. Why am I looking over here? But worked very, very hard on that. And the unfortunate part is that concussion problems tend to manifest most under duress. Mm-hmm. So when you're rowing, and you're under a high form of fatigue and stress. And sometimes that's when my brain is at the worst. So in the end, it all worked out quite well because I ended up in the middle of the boat with very strong women on either side of me, where my roles and my responsibilities were fairly limited. Not a lot of, you know, high maths involved. I just had to pull hard.
That's awesome. You know, like when I hear that, I think there's so much more depth to what you're saying. And I recently had Dr. Michael Gervais, I think I shared the episode with you on my podcast, but I shared that episode with you. And Dr. Michael Gervais is a high performance psychologist who has worked with numerous Olympic athletes and elite athletes from multiple different sports. And I want to share a quote with you that I write down a lot of quotes. And the quote that he has is, "Optimal performance begins in maximum frustration. And while flow is an incredible high, it can start with a deep low." So, and there's evidence to back that up, that a lot of elite athletes, it's not just about being able to achieve success all the time, but you absolutely have to sit in these incredible lows and learn how to navigate them and either quit or move forward. And your story Yes. embodies moving forward.
Well, thank you. And I think that we can take that to even higher level, right? So if you want to look at the surface level of performing well on the world stage.
Yeah.
Someone very wise and with an Olympic medal to her name told me that the key to a good Olympic final is about knowing how to recalibrate. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to push. We've all had those races where you get to you have a certain start time and that start time moves. Maybe there's thunder and lightning. Maybe there's, delays, and those things are all outside of your control. And as an athlete, it's your responsibility to recalibrate from that so that you're ready when you need to, because at the end for us, we only really get 6 minutes. So, just quickly fast forwarding to the Olympic final, pushing off the dock to thunder rolling through the air, and you're going, okay, this might mean that we're going to be pulled. All my caffeine is going to be wasted. All of my pre-race is going to have to be done again. All of my mental focus is going to have to be done again. But being so ready, because we'd practiced this so many times, that if we have to recalibrate, we are a gold, medal capable crew, and we can do that.
Yeah, that's great. And one of the things I've learned about you through some research and just knowing more about your story is the power of optimism. And again, this is rooted deeply in positive psychology, you know, and Dr. Martin Seligman started the positive psychology movement decades ago. And why he started it was he was a clinical psychologist and he was tired of clinical psychology looking at why people are so screwed up. And he said, how about we look at what's great about them and what's working and what their strengths are and just focus on that. So he says that at the heart of it is optimism, which is a belief in a positive future, and that optimism is the engine and attitude to persist. And often what happens there with optimism is having a deep sense of what's going on inside with our own thoughts and being able to navigate those thoughts. And when we met at the airport, I gave you my favorite quote. I wrote it down.
Yes, you did.
In a little card for you. And I want to read that quote again, because that quote has helped me through some very difficult times. And it's helped me to understand that we are the master storyteller in our own lives. And the quote is, "The power broker in your life is the voice that no one hears. How well you revisit the tone and content of your private voice is what determines the quality of your life. It is the master storyteller, and the stories we tell ourselves are our reality." So as an elite athlete going through what you've gone through, being 27 and never having rowed in your life, and then suddenly embarking on this career of excellence in rowing, there has to be something to you, the inner voice. So can you just take us through the evolution of your own inner voice and how that has changed over time and how you've learned to navigate your inner voice in a way that empowers you to always move forward in the most positive and productive ways possible?
Yes, I mean, that's such a great question. And I think that when you're speaking to yourself, the person who's listening is you. So that there's absolutely so much power in what you tell yourself and how you shape your own reality. So I think that really what I'd love to do is just quickly share how I started rowing, because I think that will tell the story for itself. So as we mentioned, hotel manager, 27. If I went for a half hour run, then I was real proud of myself. I wouldn't say, you know, full couch potato, but definitely going there, working a corporate job, not really in shape. And in a place that I think a lot of people can find where you're just stuck. You have a job, that's okay, and things are going okay, but there's just something missing. And previously, I had that void filled by lots of traveling, backpacking adventures. I like to climb mountains. I like to go places I've never been before. I want to be on every continent before I die. But I was just stuck. So I decided to go and do Tough Mudder, which your listeners might know is a bit of an adventure tour. So you climb over things, under things, and through mud and electrical wires. It's good fun with a team. On my very first obstacle course, one of our teammates twisted his ankle. And I was like, ooh, that's too bad, buddy. You know, like, I'll see you at the end. But he was crawling on his hands and knees because he said, no, I have trained for this. I'm going to do this. And I need to complete this. This is important to me. And I went, wow, you know, saw this fire in his eyes, a fair play. So myself and one of the other guys stayed behind and piggybacked him very slowly through the entire course, through those electrical wires and through the mud. And I got home from that, sitting at Thanksgiving dinner with my parents and a family friend, and just was so inspired. And when I want to do something like that, I want to have a goal and I want to achieve it. I want to do something I've never done before. Like, maybe let's dream big, maybe a marathon. Wouldn't that be amazing?
And our family friends, your mother had done the Boston Marathon, right?
She has. Yeah, yes. Yeah. She's such an inspiration. Yeah. I want to do something like that. Something that I've never done before. And a family friend said, well, you know, you should try this sport called rowing. I went, no, you don't understand. I want to do something hard. Which anyone who's experienced a sport will find that funny, because this is a pain sport. It is a hard sport. It starts with a sprint. It ends with a sprint. And we are sprinting in the middle as well. It is tough. But I didn't know anything about rowing. And so I went, well, you know, why not? I'll sign up for a club. I'll meet new people. I'm 6'1". So supposedly I have what it takes. And I ended up accidentally signing up for talent identification program. Well, actually, my parents signed me up while I swirled my glass of wine and went, oh yeah, sure, I could do rowing. And I showed up and I did the testing and they said, yeah, you know, we think that you have what it takes, but you need to train with us 6 days a week, 2 or 3 sessions a day for no money. We'll provide the coaching and the equipment, and you have to show up and do the work, and you need to tell us soon, which meant, because of the nature of my job, needed to give them lots of notice. So I actually had to quit my job before I'd even step foot in the boat.
That's amazing.
So, I mean, I just wanted to do like a running race. This is really not what I signed up for. So I called my parents up, because they're always a wealth of knowledge. And my father, being German, is incredibly practical. Yeah. If anyone's going to talk me out of it, it's got to be him. And they surprised me. They said, Andrea, you never want to wonder what if. Just go and see how fast you can be. Work will always be there for you. You don't want to be wondering 10 years from now what you could have achieved. I went, all right, well, I went to work, quit my job. They said, oh, we didn't know you row. I go, I don't. It's going to be great. And off I went, and I was awful. I was awful. I fell out of the boat so much. And I started rowing in November in Canada, which was not my wisest move. Very, very cold. Mm-hmm. But that drive of what if took me all the way to the final of the Olympics, where here we are. And that imposter syndrome followed me along for a long time, even as I switched disciplines. Who am I to be here? How amazing is it that I get to be here? I get to do this. But that what if really got us to that gold medal, because I think dreaming big, dreaming gold, was almost too big for me to wrap my head around. So you had to break it down. Okay, how do I get a gold medal? Well, to get a gold medal, I have to have my best race. How do we have our best race? Well, we have our best race by doing all the little things right and crossing that finish line, looking at each other and saying, we were brave. We did what we said we were going to do. We stuck to the plan and we didn't leave anything behind and anything out there. And if you can achieve something and say, you just did your very best and this is what you're capable of, then what a powerful opportunity to say, hey, I'm fifth in the world, or, hey, I made it to the provincial team. And that's as fast as I can be. But how empowering is that? So, you know, I think in getting to your question about optimism, I think it's optimism, yes, but also just curiosity and challenging myself and trying to see where failure is and what's possible.
Yeah.
Because until you run into that, you never know where your limits are, right?
Yeah. And that's that evidence around, there's a book called Atomic Habits and the work of Stephen Kotler, who wrote The Rise of Superman and The Art of there you go, Atomic Habits, James Clear. I got it right over here too. But it's that idea, especially Kotler's work around the Art of Impossible, is that in order to find flow, we have to challenge ourselves in a way. He calls it the challenge skills sweet spot. So if it's too easy, you're going to get bored and not really learn or develop resilience. If it's just absolutely impossible, you're setting yourself up for consistent failure. So you have to be in that optimal zone, right? So I guess when I think of your inner voice and some of your failures, I know you were cut in was it 2017 when you were cut from the national team?
Yes, I wasn't cut, but I failed to make my world's
you failed to make the world team. So again, that's failure had revealed itself, but what was your inner voice like through all of that? Was it a kind, supportive voice? Did it kind of kick you in the ass a bit to not that you needed to get going, but just take us through what that voice was like for you during those lower moments when you were really challenged.
Absolutely. So let's take 2017, because I think that's a great example. So how rowing works is you have to be fast enough to get an audition onto the national team. So that means you need to complete a series of on-water events and off-water events that get you an invitation onto the national team. Once you're on the national team, you also then have to train with your national team and race against them to try and make it onto what we call the world's team. So that's the crew that goes to the World Cups. And then after that, they select who's going to go to the World Championships. So I didn't make the first World Cups team. I didn't make it. And so the rest of the team went off to London, Ontario, where they're training at the time. And I was left behind to do pretty much, my coach said, do whatever you want. You know, you're not my problem right now. I'll see you in November for nationals after the whole international racing is over. Come back faster. So I was given kind of carte blanche to do whatever I wanted. And that included, I could walk away and say, well, I wasn't fast enough. But I had some messages from some of the girls on the team that had similar stories. Look, I didn't make my first world's team, you know, figure out where your gaps are. And I think it comes back to trying to figure out, okay, well, if I'm going to walk away from sport, it's going to be on my own terms. And so I need to be able to live with that. And I need to know that I did everything I possibly could. So the voice inside of my head was like, look, you just got to make sure that you've turned over every rock. And so the rock that I turned over was reaching out to a friend of mine in the UK. So the previous year I had funded myself to go and do a couple of races in Europe because I just needed some international racing experience. It was a big gap in my knowledge. And I reached out to one of her and I said, look, you know, all the fast people are gone from Canada. There's really no one here to push me. I don't know where I can go to train. There's no one even here to coach me. She said, oh, well, you could come over to the UK. And 5 days later, I think I had the plane ticket and I flew over to the UK and I spent the whole summer there learning from people, being coached by people in ways that I've never been coached before, training with people I've never trained with before, and getting a whole bunch of skills and experiences under my belt. That meant that when I came back the next year, I was faster than ever before and went on the following season to make the world's team and medal at my very first international event.
That's amazing. That's amazing. So absolutely acting on that feedback. I mean, you received feedback by not making that team. And your feedback was that you needed to look within and figure out what was next. And you acted on that feedback in a way that allowed you to keep moving forward. And I want to ask you about the role of visualization before we move into the work you're doing now, speaking. I had Simon Whitfield on the podcast, the great Canadian gold medalist in triathlon. And Simon, amazingly, such an amazing story, but I never knew he left Canada to train in Australia as a 15-year-old. And then he's training. He was about 17 years old when it was announced that the 2000 Olympics were going to be in Sydney. That was going to be like 7 years later. So he's 17. He found that news out and he goes by himself. Everybody's partying and drinking, going crazy in the streets. And he walks right down to where the start line is going to be for the triathlon. He knows where the race is going to be. And he stands there by himself and visualizes the start of the race 7 years later and visualizes winning the gold medal. And he is such an advocate. His whole career was based on visualization. Professional athletes and elite athletes tinker with visualization in different ways, but can you just take us through visualization, and does it play a role in what you do? And if so, what does it look like in your mental training?
Yes. So visualization definitely plays a role. Now, I know some of my teammates visualize more than I do. I can't say that I'm a great, even a meditator. So sometimes this is difficult for me, but visualization has cropped up in three distinct ways for me. So the first would be war games. I don't know if anyone else on my team does this, but I did it certainly in the beginning when I was in a single and it was just me. When it's just you in the boat. And I would sit down, piece of paper and whatever bottle caps I could find. And I would put myself and I'd assign the people I was racing against different little bits. And I would make a snapshot. Okay, we're at the 1,000 meter mark and this is what the field looks like. What do I do? And I just think about that. What would my plan do? Okay, now we're at the 500 to go. We're almost at the finish because it's a 2,000 meter race. Okay, what am I going to do there? Is this a red light moment, a green light moment, or a yellow light moment? The second way I visualized was at the start of the race, it's very quiet. We're not like a lot of sports where you have people cheering. So quite often, what I would do is I would go to the start line of a race. I'm thinking about Hollenbecker in the Netherlands in particular, and I would take my phone out and I would just record whatever the noises were. So sometimes the noises are planes flying overhead. Sometimes it's birds chirping. Sometimes it's cars going by. And I would play that back to myself at night and just try and get into that state of calm readiness. Because at the start, you need to be all of those nerves are bubbling over, right? Mm-hmm. If everyone, especially Olympians, get nervous, it's something we all experience. But it's about how to manage those nerves. So I like to imagine it myself as being a pot of boiling water on simmer. So you can't be cold, you can't be bubbling over, just on simmer. Feel those butterflies and just be ready, right? So what does that sound like when I'm there? And then moving into a larger boat where now it's there's nine of us together. We would do visualizations quite often, especially as racing got closer. So our coxswain, Kristen Kitt, would call us all. We would lie down in our beds, close our eyes. She would start her timer and she would calmly go through our race plan and tell us what was happening, what we were doing, what our next plan was. And we would just see it in our mind's eye, removed from the anxiety and the emotions of it, and just see the race plan for what it was and be calm about it. Cause especially in our women's eight crew, I think that's what Kit did so well, our coxswain. We're all very, very strong, energetic people, and we will go if you let us. So her job was just to kind of keep our blinders on, keep us calm, keep us in the boat. And then when she said go, man, the boat just flies.
Awesome. That's so cool. And in our time left, like, can you just describe, obviously, like, winning the gold medal was an amazing moment and such a special moment for Canada. And Justin Trudeau right away was putting stuff out on social media, congratulating the nine of you. And it was such an emotional moment for many Canadians to watch your success. And especially in the time of COVID and, you know, the world being a shitty place because of the pandemic, and then seeing this great effort on your part to represent Canada. So as a Canadian living abroad for 25 years, that was a really proud moment for me watching you. And then I met you at the airport, which is even cooler. But what has it been like for you since that time? And how have you learned to deal with the after effects of the race? And like, there's so much dopamine, such a dopamine rush and so much celebration. How have you learned to navigate that into, I don't want to say normal routine life, but what has that journey been like since Tokyo for you? And how do you keep yourself motivated? And this will probably be a nice segue into the work you're doing with Classroom Champions, but also your keynote speaking. So just talk about how you're learning to navigate post-Olympics to stay motivated, because a lot of athletes crash after such success.
Absolutely. Yeah. So Jason Dorland, another Canadian national treasure, along with Simon Whitfield, he wrote a fantastic book. And what I really took out of that and out of the advice of a lot of people much smarter than me was that after the Olympics, there is a period of depression. There is a period of reconciliation. There's a period of new self-identity. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think that it was going to be smart for me to go back to my apartment where everything was built around an identity that I no longer had. Whether I was going forward to 2024 or not, right now, I was no longer training for the Olympics. That was done. So what I decided to do is fly straight from Japan to the UK and compete 11 days later in another rowing event just for fun. But it was one of these events that has always been at the top of my radar. It's called Henley Royal Regatta. It's prestigious, been going long longer than the Olympics. Yeah. And I just always wanted to do that. And more importantly, after that, what it allowed me to do is allow me to celebrate with people in my sport and then travel around the UK with my mom, spending some quality family time, and have some adventures and some wanderlust and process in the background. And I did find that there were lots of days where I'd just be down and frustrated for no reason. And it's really hard to reconcile. Why am I upset right now? Mm-hmm. So it has been an ebb and flow. But taking that time to process allowed me to come home with my feet on the ground and really enjoy the moment. And I've been having... anyone who follows me on social media can see that my medal goes lots of places with me, everywhere with me, because I love sharing. It's like having a superpower. You can make people happy wherever you go. And that's so cool. And I did have problems at first sharing it with people, because especially in Canadian rowing, it is a very humble sport. So you go up, you get your medal, then it's tucked into your spandex unisuit, never to be seen again. It's just something that you have for yourself. You don't wear it to the after party or anything like that. Until a friend of mine from Classroom Champions, the CEO, Steve Messler, he has a gold as well, said, you know, Andrea, no one's going to remember your name or what seat you are in or even what sport you did. But I promise you, every single person is going to remember holding that gold medal in their hand and the weight of it and how special it is. And that's the gift that you get to give to other people. So I'm getting better at bringing it along with me. Back here, feet on the ground, and it's new and different because now all of a sudden the benchmarks has shifted. For 8 years, my entire goal was to go in a straight line backwards over 2 kilometers as fast as I possibly can. And now I'm an adult with no sports psychologist and a physiologist and you know, chiropractors and training instructors and looking over my shoulder and saying, here are your goals. This is what you need to achieve. This is what you need to hit. Now it's me setting those goals. And that's terrifying and overwhelming and exciting and empowering all at the same time. So I found a couple of ways to take all of my energy and use that for good. I've just been accepted my nomination onto the board of directors for Athletes Can, which is Canada's only independent sporting organization. We provide athletes across Canada with the resources and tools they need for everything from managing safe work environments and sporting environments to negotiating athlete agreements with their national sport organizations. So that's really, really fulfilling work. I also get to do some work with Classroom Champions, which is a phenomenal organization. I've been with them for about 3 years now. They're across North America, and they pair underfunded classrooms with high-performance athletes where we teach the kids lessons that go beyond the field of play, like teamwork and leadership and dealing with big emotions. Mm-hmm. And that has been so fulfilling. I actually would watch some of the videos that the kids would send me before I did my Olympic racing, which was just so cute, you know, just little videos of them going, do your best, just have fun. And I go, yeah, that is why I'm here. I am here just to do my best and have fun. And then I also get to do some speaking work as well, not just in the classrooms, but with multinational organizations like Amazon, where I get to talk about failing forward, managing burnout, motivation, the power of what if. And actually, the power of what if is something I want to touch on really, really quickly. You were talking about the dopamine of crossing the finish line and what that must have felt like. And there's no high that's ever going to compete to that in my life. You cross the finish line and our coxswain is standing up in the boat and she's pointing at us and she seems real excited. And I'm like, I think we did it. She seems real excited. We come off the water and immediately you have minutes to throw on your clothes and go out and get your medal. There's barely any time for water. And the night before, you pack up all of your podium gear. So for us, that was like thick sweatpants and a big zip-up hoodie. And my parents have this really cute habit of sending me, tradition of sending me little post-it notes with little messages doing well. And I had packed two post-it notes into my podium gear that regardless of how it went, I would be proud to read. And one was from my mom telling me how proud she was of me. And the other was from my dad and just said, now you never have to wonder what if.
That's beautiful.
So lucky to have them.
That's beautiful. And like I said, you know, you're in a position now to make a massive difference in the world to young people. And I can just say Eli and Ty, my boys being able to hold the gold medal. What an extraordinary experience at Pearson Airport, you know? So just to see that they had smiles on their face and my son posted it right away on Instagram and talked about it. And when I think of you and where you're at right now and even my own life. And I mentioned Stephen Kotler's work, The Art of Impossible is his latest bestseller. And he talks about the importance of having a massively transformational purpose that is beyond us, that is greater than us. So that when we can root ourselves in that massively transformational purpose and do work to empower others to achieve excellence in their own way, then that is what leads to the greatest fulfillment in life. And I think that's probably what you're toggling with now, you know, like finishing, I don't know if you've done your career or not, but moving into the speaking and working with students and working with the athletic organization in Canada. What was the name again?
Athletes Can.
Yeah, Athletes Can. You know, there's so much potential there for you to develop your own massively transformational purpose and go on and do great things in the world. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what happens for you in your journey. And when you project forward 10, 20, 30 years, what is your biggest hope and what's the legacy you want to leave behind?
The legacy that I want to leave behind is pretty simple, especially in the sporting organization. I don't want us to be a flash in the pan crew, lightning in a bottle. I want to be the beginning of a golden age because we went through such massive cultural changes in the past year where we found a really amazing, supportive, athlete-centered, holistic way forward for our crew that I believe could definitely be the start of a golden age for Canada. My dream is that in the next Olympics, they go and they win 3 golds. Yeah. That would just be fantastic. And I'm here, whether it's going to be in the boat or from the sidelines, cheering them on and helping in any way I can.
Yeah, great. Well, my son Eli, who you met, he's taking a gap year next year. He graduates this year. He just picked up the game of golf 3 years ago. I've been an avid golfer my whole life. I played competitive football, University of Windsor. I was a quarterback and a punter and avid golfer. And I never wanted to push my boys into sport. But then Eli found a passion through sport because there was a professional tournament here in Saudi. So he got to meet some of the best players in the world. So his dream is to get a golf scholarship. And his game has improved so much. And I will never tell him it's so difficult to get a scholarship. You started the game so late. Your story is an inspiring story. And I told him when I learned more about you that you didn't start rowing until you were 27. So it gives kids like Eli a very important message that you don't have to think that because you didn't start the game at an early age that you don't have what it takes. You can do anything when you set your mind to it and you push yourself and you challenge yourself. So your story really is important. So can you tell the listeners where they can find you on social media? And in particular, I have a bunch of listeners from the Physical Education Network worldwide, and there's a lot of conferences. And I would highly recommend any conference organizers to reach out to you and bring you in to be a keynote speaker because your story is very empowering. So just let people know where they can find you, your website, social media, all of that.
Absolutely. I'd love to connect with anyone on Instagram or Twitter. It's at Andrea Proske, Proske, or andreaproske.com. And whether it's for an organization or just to say hello, I love talking to people. So I hope anyone who's listening wants to reach out and say hi, that they do so.
Okay, great. So Andrea, thank you so much. You know, I really appreciate your time and it was great to connect with you and learn more about you. And I'm sure that your story will really inspire many of the listeners out there. So thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Okay, I'm just going to close off the show, then I'll say goodbye to you. So everybody, thank you very much for listening to this episode with Andrea Proske, and I hope you come back to listen to future episodes.
You're listening to the Run Your Life podcast with host Andy Vasily.